All right, it's Liam. I want to thank everyone at the Oasis podcast, as you were.
So to give you a bit of history about myself, I first heard Oasis in 1994, but didn't grab onto them straight away. I think the first time I heard them was seeing Shaker Maker on the chart show, which you're from the UK and you grew up in the 90s. You might remember that one of the few places to watch music videos, this is pre-MTV in the UK, or very, very early, that not many of us had MTV. So one of the early only places you could watch music videos was on the chart show on Channel 4 on a Saturday morning. And they would do the indie chart or the rock chart or the pop chart, and you would sit there and watch and wait. And they had this weird thing where they would like fast forward through some videos and then they would play some videos. And yeah, I remember seeing this weird band with that kind of that sort of swagger and that funny haircut that I'd seen in quite a few other bands at the time, like a lot of those Manchester bands like the Charlatans. And yeah, I thought they sounded all right. It didn't really do anything for me, to be honest. I sort of just thought, oh, it's another one of those bands. I mean, I'm 14 at the time in 1994, so I'm not actually that bothered about indie music at that point. And then later on, as 94 wore on, I mean, I remember hearing more and more about this band Oasis as the album. I remember hearing that it had been the fastest selling album and all that sort of stuff. And so I started paying a bit more attention to them. And then by the time we're at the end of 94 and the likes of Cigarettes and Alcohol coming out, and then definitely by Whatever coming out, I remember that very, very clearly. I'm really liking that song Whatever, and I just think it was really interesting. But a big thanks for getting me into Oasis, and also half of the kids in our school needs to go to a guy called Will Cooper, who is at Will Cooper on Twitter, because he went and recorded us. Basically, he had all the singles and Definitely Maybe. And so he put together a legendary mixtape with Definitely Maybe on one side and all the B-sides on the other side. And that was just hammered and played and played and played and played until it probably fell to bits. So a big thank you to Will Cooper for showing me the light, getting me into Oasis. As we then went into sort of 95, I kind of went all in, really. So by the time we get to sort of summer 95, we were all completely fully on board with Oasis. I remember that summer very clearly with, you know, the Battle of Britpop and Roll With It coming out and all that sort of stuff. So absolutely loved them. Getting into 96, I saw them in Cardiff. For the first time in March 96, and then went to Nebworth and saw them there as well, which was a mind-blowing, kind of life-changing experience. And it was actually then coming out of Nebworth, decided to start a band. And yeah, so contacted a very good friend of mine who you'll hear also on this podcast in the future, a guy called Joel, and we formed a band with a few other friends. And yeah, and that was how I spent sort of the end of my teens and into my early 20s, sort of gigging around unsuccessfully trying to be a musician. But the effect on me of Oasis was that I changed my haircut, I changed the way I dressed, I just went fully in, fully on board. I may have even occasionally walked with a slight Liam Gallagher swagger, and possibly as well my regular Oxfordshire accent may have been replaced with a slight Mancunian drawl. Just briefly in that mid-90s.
All right, I'll Kev.
Oh, Perry, how is Manchester?
Yeah, you know, results sorted, top mad for it.
Did you go and see Oasis?
I might have done, who's asking?
Me.
Oh, yeah, right, sorted, top mad for it.
Were they brilliant?
Yeah, they were great, you know, but I don't know, like, you know, because I was so out of it, you know.
How is your auntie?
That has been. I don't know, who cares, you know, the way I look at it, Kev, you know, there's only two type of people, right? There's us and there's wankers.
Yeah, right, our para, sorted.
So how's this dead town been when I've been away?
Oh, it's been a right bummer.
Chill out, Kev, and get one on.
Oh, cheers, Perry. I mean, para. Sorted. Yeah, it's been a roller boring week. Yeah. I've been in my room most of the week, listening to Oasis records. I know all the words.
That's totally uncool, you know. Learning words is what you do at school. Teachers teach you how to be stupid.
Hello, Perry. Did you have a nice time in Manchester?
Yes, thank you, Miss Pettison.
Gosh, you've drawn a little bit of a beard on. How very grown up.
Thank you. I really like your mum, you know. I feel like I'd like to shag her.
Yeah, I'd like to shag your mum too.
Right, I'm off out. I'm going to go and beat up a couple of cockney bastards. You coming?
Yeah, great. Yeah, I'll have some bread and dripping for us teas, our mother.
Kevin, why are you talking in that extraordinary way?
I don't know what that's talking about.
Why are you pretending to be a northerner? You sound very silly.
You don't know nout. I'm real. You're just loving their lies. I hate you. All around the world, you gotta spread the word. Tell them what you
heard. You know it's gonna be okay. I wasn't planning on this being a news-based podcast because Oasis split up 7 years ago, 8 years ago. So, you know, well, what news is there when they split up? Who doesn't appear to be getting back together anytime soon? But it just so happens that Liam Gallagher's been in the news quite a lot. So his the rumour is that his first single as a solo artist will be called Bold, and a mock-up of what potentially could be the cover of the single has got out there, has been leaked. And it's just sort of a profile shot of Liam with the word bold. So whether or not that's anything, we don't know. So we'll wait and see what happens with there. I think bold is a pretty decent name for a song. People are saying that it could potentially be this song, which was captured on YouTube with Liam on holiday in Ireland a few months ago. And so it could be. Let's have a listen.
When I wake up, I thought to say, and I'm not
So we were talking about your favourite song, and I was expecting, with your sort of punk background, I was thinking it was going to be something like Head Shrinker or Bring It On Down, some of these sort of really early, definitely maybe B-sides that have got that just stripped down rock sound to them. Well, and yeah, I was quite surprised to hear your choice.
I find myself discovering those now, which is great, but that's not, like I was saying, that's not the kind of stuff that broke through, so it wasn't really the kind of stuff I was more familiar with.
Okay. And your favorite song is?
All Around the World.
Which is crazy to me. Yeah, that's mad. I mean, can you remember, did that make a big splash when that came out over there?
Here's the thing. It was certainly a single that, you know, became, yeah, it played on the radio here and people were aware of it. And yeah, it was a hit and all that. But for me specifically, I've got to say I had... So it's a bit of an odd story to recount, but I was in high school and I would stay up, all hours, and I would keep the TV on and I would want to see music videos. I loved music videos. And yet this was a time where on MTV here, they were actually becoming, you know, less and less common to show up on MTV, the music videos. They were being replaced with all these reality shows and competition shows and this and that. And even TRL would be more people talking about the videos than them actually being on there. And so late at night is where you'd be able to see them. They just have these huge chunks of video after video after video. And one night when I was just, you know, glued to my screen, just, you know, I just want to watch a few more. That one came on, and it was the first time I'd heard the song. And so, and I don't know if I was semi-delirious or what, but it almost felt like I don't want to exaggerate, but like, I don't know, like an out-of-body experience watching that video. It was just really incredible to me because it was the first time I'd heard the song. And obviously, if, you know, if you recall that video, it's just got a lot of kind of trippy visuals, not even all that trippy, just, you know, it made me think of a lot of things like, you know, Beatles and Monty Python. And it's just got those kind of, definitely, you know, random, absolutely, you know, animated elements that, you know, everything feels like it's kind of making a statement, and it's all just that very simple animation. But it was just going from scene to scene, and it was all brightly colored, and I was like, this is amazing. And it blew me away. It really did. And it, like, it almost brought me to tears. But the song itself, if you can imagine my sort of semi-delusional state, and you've mentioned this, I think, in our preliminary talks, is just how it builds and builds and just gets bigger and bigger. And like, key changes and more layers and horns and whatever else. And that it just felt epic, you know.
Especially in that video as well, when, you know, there's that huge kind of... at the end,
and it's just
and it goes up and up and up, and that sort of the little thing that had started like a tiny little ship has grown into this huge like monster ship. And then
visually the same thing is happening as the building of the music itself,
and then there's like an egg on the top, isn't it, and then it opens up and there's Noel to the very top like playing like and doing his na na na, and then
it's genius. It's fascinating.
It was a perfect encapsulation. If a music video is there to encapsulate a song, right, I think that's exactly the perfect music video.
And it made it feel like such this big anthem, and I was blown away. And so ever since then, it's had this real impact on me. And so I'll listen to it to get pumped up, and it just keeps going. Every time you think it's about to end, it steps it up one more time, and it's so exciting. And so I was really interested in you, like right away when I had told you that, you sent me that clip of them playing it like before they had even gotten their big break. Like that was one of their seemingly like earliest things that they would jam on. Mm. And I was like, oh, that's so cool. And they just held it in reserve until they could just blow us away with the crazy production value and epicness of it. So cool.
That it's mad that, so in, and I'll drop it in here. But one of the things I wanted to mention, and Noel, can we have a bit of sad song here, please? Thank you. I'm going to get a bit more serious now. One of our loyal listeners and a friend on Twitter is a young lady by the name of Oasis. That's right, her name is actually Oasis. And sad news. Sad news, she broke up with her boyfriend last week. So she's feeling quite upset about that. And we as a community, as a collective, have the power to do something about it. So I've started the hashtag already. It is Find Oasis a Husband. If you are single, if you're male, if you preferably, if you look a bit like Liam Gallagher, although I think she'd probably take a bonehead lookalike right now, then get in touch. Use that hashtag, Find Oasis a Husband. Drop me a tweet at Oasis Podcast. And let's help her out. Let's rekindle Oasis's love life. I think she's in California, but if you happen to be very rich somewhere else in the world and want to fly her over, or you want to come over and see her, then that would be amazing. Find Oasis a Husband. Hashtag get on it. We'll be right back.
Betty. I think you recorded whatever before you did The White Room.
Well, you'd know better than I would, being a discographer, but I'm pretty lax about that side of my career. If you go on my band website, all my discography's there.
Yeah.
And ask me what order it was all in. I have no idea.
Yeah, well,
I'm useless with times.
Well, I think...
anyway...
Because whatever would have been late 94, and then that came out as a single in 94, and I think that White Room stuff was then into 95.
Okay, Jane. Well, you've educated me. All I will tell you is that that was done then, as far as I was concerned. It was done, and then the phone went one day and said, "Look, they're doing some live stuff now. I don't know if the MTV show where they had the fight up in the gods was before the Nebworth, was it?"
I think that was... Well, I'm not sure off the top of my head. I think that's after Nebworth, I think.
Okay, well, whatever I did, they asked me to do it live as well. But it wasn't only me, because Isabel fixed the whole of the brass as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So that brass section, including Steve Sidwell and the guys, all them big guys, the trumpet player was actually the one that played, would you believe, on Sergeant Pepper.
No, really? Some of that brass section?
The guy that played the lead trumpet on Sergeant Pepper was, as far as I know, the lead trumpet player on those Oasis sessions.
Wow.
Derek Watkins.
Okay.
He was part of the brass ensemble, the section that we had at times with Oasis. Now, when I did that, the Unplugged Oasis, which was from the Royal Festival Hall.
Okay.
I didn't get no guidance from Noel on that. I know that he was pretty fed up because they'd had a bit of a round, a pair of them.
Yeah, well, Liam was supposed to sing that show, and then he decided not to, and then ended up in the God shouting abuse at Noel for the rest of the show.
Correct. It wasn't the first time that happened. I think that happened a couple of times, but there was still a good family bond there. However much they were, they seemed close to me from the outside looking at you, you know.
Yeah.
I went in and I remember Noel just giving me a kind of nod, and I just started to play on it, but none of that was rehearsed.
Really?
Absolutely.
That is crazy.
Didn't rehearse that. I think I did the master plan on that. I played on the master plan.
Yeah.
And I look back at it now, because my son's a collector of what I do as well, and he said, "Dad, have you seen that?" And I said, "No." He said, "It's fantastic." And it's kind of grainy old footage of it, you know, but I said, I can't remember it. Was there any sheet music on? No, there wasn't. He just kind of went, "Mark, do what you want on it." You know, he was so fed up with what had gone down. So I just opened it up and closed it. And that was totally, totally unrehearsed.
Yeah.
Could be any one of these songs could have been a hit, you know, like it's something that anyone could have listened to. So it's like it's got all that attitude that they have, but Noel Gallagher can't help but like write these like great effective pop songs or songs that, you know, sound like they could be, you know, a good old, you know, Stones, you know, rock and roll song that everybody loved in the 60s, but it's just got a lot more fuzz and a lot more attitude and, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, that's kind of my like overall kind of feeling about it. But the song that was my favorite was "Ain't Got Nothing."
Oh, really? That's interesting. So just for the benefit of the listeners, I mean, the kind of what I sent over was what, as I say, were the ones that I'd picked out and the ones that people have mentioned on Twitter. So I'd sent over "Bring It On Down," "Head Shrinker," "The Meaning of Soul," "Fade Away," obviously the Definitely Maybe version, "Eyeball Tickler," "My Big Mouth," "My Generation," "Ain't Got Nothing," "I Got the Fever," "I Can See a Liar," "Come On Feel the Noise," and "Fucking in the Bushes." And so, yeah, and so Ain't Got Nothing is from Dig Out Your Soul. So that's from the last
album.
That's
a later one.
Yeah, that's from the last album. And that is written by Liam as well. You've picked a Liam, you've picked a Liam song.
Well, great. there is something different about it. So that's really not that surprising to me because, like, you know, I definitely felt like, okay, well, this sounds like Oasis. You know, it's a little bit heavier. It's a little bit harder. It's a little bit grimier. But Ain't Got Nothing was the kind of song that was, like, special and different to me. You know, it's got that gnarly kind of slow groove.
Yeah.
And it actually has, I feel like, a bit of a sneer to it, whereas I feel like all these other songs that you sent me still had, you know, like I said, that polish, that pop, you know, that pop song kind of polish, but, like, Ain't Got Nothing was different. It's kind of like the, you know, the I Want You, She's So Heavy, you know, kind of version of Oasis, you know, that just had this, like, you know, kind of dark, riffy, heavy, repetitive kind of thing, and it was slower tempo.
In terms of the phenomenon and the size, I'll give you an example. The mid-90s, knocking about with Oasis was like a cross between a Laurel and Hardy film and Hard Day's Night. It was bonkers. A specific example that springs to mind is every Friday night when they weren't away, Liam would turn up at my flat in Camden Town because he knew that whatever happened wouldn't reach the press because we were all a tight group together and there's nobody selling stories. And then on the Saturday morning, we'd get up and there was a little Greek cafe on Parkway just near the Spread Eagle pub called George and Nicky's, and we go there for our breakfast or stroke lunch. Yeah. And this is literally 100 yards from my flat. And in that 100 yards from walking from my flat to the cafe, I saw a car running the back of a bus as the guy driving it swiveled his head, goes, fucking hell, it's Liam Gallagher. Another guy on a push bike went all wobbly and fell over, nearly killed himself. And a woman who must have been in her late 40s, early 50s, dropped all her shopping and started screaming. And this was just every day, wherever he went, wherever Liam Gallagher went, absolute chaos would break out. It was like being in Hard Day's Night. It was mental.
But how did it affect him, though? I can probably guess the answer.
Oh, he loved it. He absolutely loved it. Of course he did. I mean, he's not one of these. The entire point to Oasis was, look, we grew up in a council estate. We are never going to shy away from the trappings of fame. You know, these other rock stars, oh, you know, it's getting to me and, oh, I can't cope with the pressure. Like, fuck that. This is what we set out to achieve in the first place. The bigger and madder it gets, the better.
Absolutely. And it's also, I mean, a modern kind of equivalent of that is hip-hop, I think, in that you get a lot of people sort of have a go at rappers for, you know, wearing gold, you know, a lot of bling and you know, and flaunting their wealth. But I think if you come from that, that's a very kind of, you know, white middle class thing to criticize, you know, where we are, you know, if you're white middle class, you're sort of desperate to hide your wealth and kind of try and slum down a little bit. But that's the thing, if you come from nothing, if you come from a council estate or if you come from the projects and then you suddenly get a bit of money, it's like, well, yeah, I'm going to flaunt this because I had nothing and now I've got this.
Yeah.
So
exactly. Sort of bands who come from wealthier backgrounds, they tended to dress down once they'd made it. You know, like, well, there's untold examples. Yet working class outfits who make it go the opposite direction. Well, that's inevitable, isn't it? And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, you know. I think Oasis were the first band in goodness knows how long to shout, yes, we've made it and we have become pop stars and we are rock stars and this is what we set out to do and we're going to have it as until it stops. And well, in the case of Oasis, I don't think it ever will stop. No. I mean, it's like, they're there now, aren't they? I mean, I think they're just, well, they're not as big as they were at the time because they've not got any records, obviously, but you look at anything to do with it. I mean, the NME repeatedly, still to this day, feature, they keep churning out old Oasis bits because they know that it's still massively popular. And anything, well, you know, look at the Supersonic film. It was a smash hit success all over the country, wasn't it? You know what I mean? People queuing up to go and see it. And it'll never die. I mean, there are Beatles. I mean, one thing I would never compare them to the Beatles is musically, because Beatles are the best band of all time and they'll never be beat, because without them, nothing else would have happened. But in terms of the phenomenon of the mid-90s, it'll be a long time before that happens again.
I mean, and you've met him as well, haven't you? Is that right?
Yeah, a couple of times. And there was a really nice thing when I met him, which was my other half, her dad, used to, actually I can't name the company he used to work for because it might get him in trouble, but he used to work for a company that took care of a lot of behind the scenes stuff at the V Festival, when the V Festival was really good. Now it's got fucking Justin Bieber playing, but he basically did this, he basically gave us these all access, all area passes, and the first year we went for like 7 or 8 years, and they literally got you onto the stage. It was crazy. And I remember being there the first day, and the Foo Fighters being there, and I met Dave Grohl and gave him a CD, because I was at a sale, I was in a band, I was desperate to be signed, gave him a CD, he went and listened to it on the Foo Fighters tour bus, which was really cool. But all I was obsessed with was like, oh, if only Oasis were playing. And then I realised on the Sunday Appleton were playing. And I thought, oh my word, Liam's going to be here. And so the next day we saw him with them, and I was like, oh, I can't, you know, they always say don't meet your heroes, right? And I was like, what if he's horrible, or if he doesn't want to talk, whatever. And I thought, I'll time it until Appleton come off stage, so they're getting a bit of attention and Liam's not centre of attention for a moment.
Perfect.
So as they were walking off stage, I went up to him, and some people who've met Liam will know this, he goes and shakes your hand. So he puts his hand out and he shook my hand, and I was kind of like, looking back now, it's a bit embarrassing, I was only about 20 or whatever, and I was a bit of a fangirl, but I was basically saying, oh, Liam, oh, I'm in a band, and you know, your greatest influence, and all this kind of thing, the kind of things you look back now and think, oh, it's a bit over the top.
Yeah.
And he was cool as a cucumber, he was such a dude, and he was talking to us for a couple of minutes, and he's looking, and the band was called Looks Like Rain, and he was looking at us, and he goes, yeah. Oh, it looks like rain, right, okay. And I went, I was so influenced by you, and he went, looks like rain, influenced by us. And I was like, yeah. And he paused, looked me in the eye, and he said, why aren't you changing the fucking world then? And it was like,
oh, what?
And he was like, what an amazing Liam Gallagher thing to say. Yeah, and he was like, why aren't you changing the fucking world then? And he said it with a cheeky grin and stuff, and it was amazing. And then we ended up chatting to him for a few minutes, and then unfortunately a photographer came along, and he then started chasing the photographer. And what it was is he had a photo on the back of his shirt. He had, I think it was a Bob Marley quote that was the whole back of his shirt. And he wanted the photographer to take a photo. And I was stood next to him as a photographer, took it. And then the Monday morning in the bizarre column of the Sun, they had the photo, but they cropped me out at the side, which is a bit of a shame. But then he shook our hands and was just, an absolute gent. And I met him again another time after he headlined V Festival as well. And I think a lot of the stuff you got to remember with Liam is that he knows that to get in the headlines he has to do certain things, and that makes them get more coverage, it makes them sell more records, makes people more talk about them. I don't think he's necessarily like he is in the press away from the scene, if you know what I mean.
I remember being sat out on the wall. There was a wall outside the venue, and I remember the band walking past me, and like everybody was sort of sat on the curb and sort of stood outside, mm-hmm. and the five of them walked past us. Liam was wearing, it's like a cricket jumper, and kind of as they walked past, none of them said anything, but you knew immediately they were a gang. You knew they were the band. Yeah. I'd never seen them from Adam, but you just saw, and straight away you could see everybody just go quiet. Everybody just stopped talking, and they just watched these five guys just walk past us and just into the venue, and then kind of everyone just kind of carried on doing whatever they were doing. They then started. They went on the top. So on the top of the venue, there was a playground, which is where our playground when I went to play school. And they were kicking a ball about. They were just playing football on the top of the, and they kept kicking the ball over, and people were like booting it back and stuff. And I mean, at the time, it was kind of, you know. But more and more people were arriving, and I've heard, I don't know because I was in the venue, but people were saying that the queues were just stretching ridiculous. It had sold out. People were just trying to get in. People were saying there were 600 or 700 people trying to get in there and just couldn't. They obviously could have sold out the main room. But I think on that tour, it was all about building up hype, and it was about kind of, you know, let's people wanting more.
I suppose that's the thing. If you like some McGee, he probably would have said, yeah, actually, let's, you know, it'd be better to have it sold out and have a massive queue round the, down the road rather than actually get everyone into the main room because then that's the bigger story.
Yeah, and if you think, you know, they did that in Northampton, then, you know, if you think other towns, bigger towns, more prestigious towns that they've kind of been to, you know, I'm pretty sure everything else was happening exactly the same way.
I remember that happening with bands, that it did have a snowball effect. I don't know if you get that anymore, but it does. You know, I remember bands coming out and they're playing the small venues or they're supporting, and then they start doing their own stuff, and then they're doing the bigger stuff, and the next time they come to town, they're into the you know, the mid-sized venue and stuff. And yeah, I mean, and that I remember that definitely being the case with them.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. In there was just like, it was raining inside the venue because, I mean, it was quite notorious for it anyway. It was just condensation. It was just, you couldn't move. And somehow I managed to get to the front. I don't really know how. I'm not really sure. But what kind of happened? So the stage would only have been kind of just above knee height. So it was, you know, it was that kind of small venue. There was no barrier in front. It was just, there's the stage. And then, you know, there's the band. Yeah, exactly. By the time they started, I ended up kind of with my back to the band, sat on the stage. I not only could I not move, but I didn't really want to move either. So security had come and they were trying to kind of pull me out, and I was sort of holding on going, I don't really want to move. This is quite cool here. But like Liam was like literally, you know, 3 foot behind me, you know, the other side of the monitor. Noel was literally, you know, 5 foot just to the side of me. And every time I kind of turned around and looked at them, they're just like staring down at me, and just, they were intimidating, like really intimidating. Yeah.
You're sat on their stage. Understandable.
No.
Get off.
You're probably right, actually. The noise was just that powerful. You couldn't really make a great deal of nuance out. It was just. I think the sound wasn't great in there anyway. It was such a small room, but it was. You felt it. You felt it more than you actually heard it. And obviously they finished on Walrus, and that was the one song that I was like, oh, they're doing this. I know this. My mum kind of has got this. This is a...
Okay.
And that was kind of the one thing that was the overriding feeling that was that kind of as I left the venue. I've got... I put it up on Twitter, but the set list. So I've got Liam's set list. And I've still got like the original ticket and everything, so it cost me like £4 to get in. You know, which is just crazy when you think about it.
Cool. So I was really taken aback when I saw that, and that was so great to get. I mean, was there much of a scrap to get hold of that set list?
I got sideswiped by the security guard. So I remember turning round, because all I had to do was pretty much just lean over the top of the monitors to actually get it. And Liam's was the nearest to me, so as I turned around and went to get it, the security guard just came out of nowhere and just kind of grabbed me and just pulled me to the side of the stage, because he thought I was after one of the guitars or something.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, oh, sorry, mate, I was just after the set list. And he was like, oh, what, one of those? And it was just, and he went and actually untaped.
He gave it to you.
And kind of went, there you go, mate. I think it was there was a lot of security around at the time. You could already see they'd spent a bit of money on the equipment. You know, they had the amps, they had the guitars, which you don't normally see, you know, bands of that playing that size of venue with that kind of, and with that the amount of security that they had as well. You know, I don't know, what can you say? I mean, it's one of them. It's like that Sex Pistols thing in Manchester. It's like, you talk to anyone in Northampton that's an Oasis fan, it's like they were at that gig.
They were all there.
And if everybody that was actually there was, you know, you'd fill a much larger size venue. Let's put it that way.
you know, Noel has now had the spotlight for a number of years. He's sort of, he's now revered. After the, in that 2000s when, you know, Oasis, you know, the value dropped quite significantly. And those sort of three 2000s albums were, you know, quite, you know, were received and they sold well, but it wasn't anything, you know, they were no longer relevant. They were no longer the band, you know, the likes of Arctic Monkeys and Coldplay and things definitely usurped them and became the biggest. Whereas now with Noel, he's sort of taken on kind of more of an elder statesman of rock kind of persona, and is, you know, is very active. He's often on Russell Brand's radio shows, he's often on the TV shows, and he's much more of that sort of TV, you know, aging rock star personality now. Whereas Liam is still just Liam. He's still, I mean, he's probably the person on Twitter that I go onto Twitter just to check if he's tweeted, because he just comes out with this, the craziest stuff. And he's,
no,
so
he's like Trump, right? I mean, you just sort of check to see what he says. I know what you mean. Yeah,
because he's so, he is like Trump in that way. Yeah.
Now, when you, I want to turn the question back on you. So, how do we think about, you know, when you read about him, it's so simplistic to say he has erratic behavior traits, right? You know, the unpredictable erratic. Is that too simplistic to try to think of him that way? Because I tend to side with the elder statesman songwriter guy, and I tend to connect with him. Can you hold for one quick second? We can edit this, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Okay, try not to laugh too much, but the reason why I had to go to the door is I saw the Federal Express guy delivering what I know this is.
What is it? It's not Sergeant Pepper.
It is Sergeant Pepper, my advance copy sent from Apple. So it could not have come at a better, weirder time. Anyway, so I did not want... I thought he was going to make me sign for it, but you know how it is. They often just leave things laying on your doorstep. I've lost many a package
that way.
Something
to leave laying on your doorstep. That's another... That's a good... What's the release date? It's 24th, I think?
It's the 26th, but it's my advanced review copy that they sent me.
Goodness me. So...
Anyway, so let's definitely continue. But my question again, I'll say it again. So
I thought you were just leaving then. So forget this. I'm going to go and listen to Sergeant Pepper.
That's right. The phone call's over. And no, anyway, let's continue with my question. I think it's one I'd love to hear your answer on. So
okay.
He's described as erratic and unpredictable. And of course, as you said before, his tweets prove it out. His behavior, particularly in the first decade of this new century, he was the story. It's been made fun of in Claymation, as I know you know.
Rock and roll is nothing highbrow, even if you got a bushy eyebrow. It's all down a presentation and a strange pronunciation. The melodies still shine, even through the nasal whine. Though the music's good when we begin it, soon you're saying, hey, wait a minute. Haven't you heard this song before? Isn't the tune a tad familiar?
Sounds bloody close to something else. Yeah. When's your museum opening?
That would be... If anybody at Ignition or anything is listening, you know, I'd love to feature all my items in one spot, one space, whether it's temporary or permanent, so we can get everything directly into the hands of fans, whether it be lyrics, studio music things. I've got amps, I've got guitars, I've got drum kits, I've got loads of handwritten lyrics, I've got live demonstration tapes, all sorts of things that I think people would really love to see, because it brings them in touch. It's like looking at the you know, the U.S. Constitution or something. You go and you see it and you don't believe it. You know it exists. Mm. But when you see it, it's completely different. And I'd like to bring that same feeling that I have when I see when I see the things that I've been fortunate enough to collect over the years. Bring that and take that to the people. I actually have a couple of things in some exhibits right now. If the British Music Experience, I've got a set of Don't Look Back in Anger lyrics. They're right next to Noel's Union Jack. And thanks to Chris at George Henry Guitars, he had contacted me and asked me if I wanted to put something in that exhibition. He also restores and is the only one who can restore and refinish a guitar to the exact specs of Noel's Main Road Union Jack, because he's the one who curates and takes care and looks after Noel's Union Jack. So if anything happens to that, so George Henry, Chris at George Henry Guitars, he's actually refinishing a good guitar for me right now, which should be done soon. So I'm really excited for that. And so it's made to the exact specifications as Noel's Union Jack. But I have that. I've put some things on exhibition in other spaces too, and I just really like to bring that to the people. So hopefully that is the ultimate plan with this collection, would be to find a venue and bring it to people. And I don't mind traveling. I don't mind putting a little bit of my part into it to help out, whether it be physically, you know, with muscle or a little bit of financially. So I'd really like to bring this to everybody. So hopefully one day that'll happen.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. That's great. And so I'm just having a look at some of the other questions, but I think it's the kind of stuff that we've answered already, like what's your most prized possession? Neil Stridiron came back and said that. I think you sort of mentioned it's the Flying V.
There's some other notable ones that I'd really like to mention, like the live demonstration tape. That, I guess, historically is very important to the story, because that is what was like the catalyst, or whatever you'd like to call it, that took Oasis. It was like their magic carpet into world stardom. Some other notable pieces are the original handwritten lyrics that Noel wrote for Some Might Say. He wrote these lyrics out and he gave them to Brian Cannon at Microdot when he was designing the sleeve. So Brian Cannon used those lyrics. He read those lyrics and made the sleeve off of those lyrics, because Noel said, you know what? Everything that are in these lyrics, I want it put into an album sleeve. So Brian had to think of a sink full of fishes. He had to think of standing at the station. He had to think of everything like that, and that's where you get the Some Might Say. And I'm fortunate enough to have those.
Feel to see your little brother like get that call to the big leagues, because I mean they were already, you know, they had a number one single like when he joined, you know.
Yeah, it was strange. I mean, I first met the band when I was doing the White Room.
Another marriage made in the White Room now, as Noel out of Oasis joins a bloke who's been making great records since the Jam's debut single of 1977. 18 years of growing up in public and still no one's seen him smile on the telly. Perhaps tonight's the night. Paul Weller, Noel Gallagher.
Right, this one's called Talk Tonight.
Got on really well with everybody. I'm still really good friends with Bonehead to the day. We still see each other, you know, quite regularly because of my connections in Manchester. And Tony McCarroll is someone that I've stayed in touch with and intermittently. And I think I've sent an invite out to Tony to come down to my little event in June in Manchester because he's a great guy. I loved his book as well. I thought it was really good.
Yeah, really lovely, wasn't it?
Excellent. And, you know, so I met them then and I kind of got sort of a strange wind that something was afoot. I didn't write too much because it wasn't my business in band politics. But essentially, it wasn't too long after we did the White Room that it became apparent that Tony was going to be replaced. And the way I kind of hear the story is that I think Paul Weller did mention to Noel that my brother was a drummer and you know, was a good drummer, and I don't know if Noel took it on board, but I'm pretty sure that you know, I'm sure there are people out there that know much more about it than me, but I'm pretty sure that Noel heard Alan playing on a with another Creation artist, Ida, I think was signed to Creation, and Alan was doing some session work with her in a studio in Fulham, and I think Noel heard the drumming and asked Alan McGee, who's that playing drums? And it was Alan, and he said, oh, is that Alan, that's Steve's brother? Yes, I think it is. So that's where the connection was actually made. And then I think, you know, Noel managed to get hold of my mum's number and left a message with my mum for Alan to call. And
no then, Twitter or Facebook that back then, was there?
No, he phoned up and spoke to my mum. That was it. That's how it happened. I remember my mum saying, well, I think this bloke Noel Gallagher's just phoned up for you, Alan. And that was it, really. And then he went down to do a rehearsal and they liked what they heard, obviously. And then the next thing, he was, I think they were doing, they did a Plymouth Pavilions or something like that. And then they were doing Glastonbury. And that was kind of very, very soon into his tenure with the band. He just grabbed the ball by the horns and went for it. And I told him, because when he said to me about that he was going to do an audition, I said, well, look, just get everything you can of the bands, learn it all, find out, you know, if there's B-sides, learn them. And I think he went for the audition. And I don't know if they played anything by Oasis. They played Beatles tunes.
Probably, yeah.
So that was it. And I mean, I'm sure that, you know, that's been elaborated on over the years, but that's kind of the skeleton of what the way I remember it all happening. And then that was it. I mean, he was gone. I think the next time I saw him was towards the end of July, and we did a festival in Switzerland called Out in the Green with REM were on, and Bo Diddley was on, and Cheryl Cole was on.
Crow.
Cheryl Crow. I get my Cheryls mixed up. You know, all lovely fellas. Cheryl Crow was on, and it was kind of it was really. I got to meet Bo Diddley, which was cool. And that was the next time that I saw him, and we had a few drinks, and they played us in the back of the coach. They took us upstairs and played us What's the Story and said, what do we think? And we were like, I think that's going to do all right.
yeah, just about.
And then he disappeared and went to Japan and America. And I just really, for that first couple of years, it would be Christmas, New Year's and birthdays. That's, you know, because he was busy. I was still doing, I mean, that kind of 95, 96 period, we were just constantly working. So, yeah. That was a really crazy time.
I mentioned in the last episode very briefly, really, about that terrible atrocity in Manchester that happened. And when anything like that happens, you know, what always comes out of it is the togetherness and the spirit of the place. And that was really amazing to see with Manchester. And a couple of things I just wanted to drop in here. So the first thing was, I don't know if you saw this, but coming out of a minute's silence, people started just spontaneously singing Don't Look Back in Anger. So that was really amazing. Let's have a little bit of that here.
Thank you.
The other big one that happened this week was the Cortinas, the band, played Old Trafford, which was just amazing. I didn't realise they had kind of 50,000 fans in the country, let alone in one city, so fair play to them. And and they also did a version of Don't Look Back in Anger, and that got an amazing response as well, as you might expect. So let's have a little bit of that. And just finally, the other thing I really wanted to play was just a little bit of the poem This Is The Place by Tony Walsh that was read out at the memorial service. And I don't know if, I imagine most people here have seen this, but I'm not going to play the whole thing. I'll just drop a little snippet in. It's nothing to do with Oasis really, but it is about Manchester, and I just thought it was such a touching tribute, and it's sort of, it's so touching. Enjoy.
Make us a record, a new number one, and make us a brew while you're up, love, go on, and make us feel proud that you're winning the league, and make us sing louder, and make us believe it, that this is the place that has helped shape the world, and that this is a place where a Manchester girl named of Emmeline Pankhurst from the streets of Moss Side. From the streets of Moss Side led a suffragette city with sisterhood pride. And this is the place with appliance of science. We're on it, atomic. We struck with defiance in the face of a challenge. We always stand tall. Mancunians in union delivered it all, such as housing and libraries and health, education and unions and co-ops, the first railway station. So we're sorry. Bear with us. We invented commuters. But we hope you forgive us. We invented computers.
Yeah, so I'm not crying. You're crying. Moving on from that, really. Onto the Oasis stuff. So it was an incredible week, as I said, for Oasis. The Noel Gallagher had his birthday party, which was a big deal. And then he was all over the radio because it was his 50th birthday. So he was on Radio X, and there was a Nothing But Noel Night on Absolute Radio and all that sort of craziness. I'll touch on that with Chris. And then also obviously with Liam. So Liam, a tweet came out sort of saying, expect something big in the morning. And then and some people said, oh, Oasis reunion. No, come on. That, we know that's not going to happen, or not in that way anyway. And and it was the announcement of these tour dates that were literally happening in a couple of days. And then the fact that this single was going to be played as well. So we heard this snippet, this 30-second snippet, which you heard at the start of the show. And then yesterday, the full version of that was then played for the first time, and it's now, the video's out, and it's now on Spotify and iTunes and all that good stuff, so it's out there.
But we were paid. But the point is, we were young, we were fans who were working for the company because we loved the music. And I remember they were, you know, hearing that they were, you know, badasses, and they were, you know, could have a reputation of not being particularly nice to the business folks. And I sort of saw that with everybody else, but it was almost like there was a knowing wink with me that they were like, well, you're just a fan and a kid, so we like you. You know? And,
yeah, I think that's definitely what comes across, you know, from the outside, is that, yeah, anyone in suits or anyone that's sort of mm-hmm. telling them what to do, you know, they just couldn't be bothered to play the game. You know, you kind of see that the band's doing these radio, you know, these rounds and rounds and rounds of interviews and things. And, you know, and a lot of them, you know, your Coldplays and people like that will just grin, put on a fake grin and just get through it and do them over and over again. Whereas the likes of Oasis, they're not going to do that. They're not going to be asked to go and totally. Speak to, like, you know, Phil and Crazy Keith on the morning show and all that
sort
of stuff.
Yeah, that's right. You know. That's right. Yeah, I mean, you know, the band, they were all, my memory, this is a long time ago, but my memory is that they were already pretty massive in the UK, and you know, here they are in the US, where at the time you know, they were still relatively unknown and playing like a tiny club that was not even sold out. And you know, superficially, like on the front, you know, what they projected was, you know, we're annoyed to be playing this small club, like, you know, where are our audiences, not being terribly, you know, in love with the small US audience that was there. You know, I know that they went on to occasionally, I think it was either that tour or following tour, they had some rude shout outs to the American audiences. I didn't see any of that, but there was a little bit of that attitude there.
Yeah.
But then kind of when the show was over and there was like the backstage stuff, like to me, they radiated a like, oh, you're right, mate. You know, like, you know, you like the record, like almost like they were pleased to see that like the real fans were coming out and wanting to learn more about the band, but they still projected this sort of sense to the record label suits and to be fair to the audience that was not sort of let behind the curtain, if you will, of you know, we couldn't be bothered and we're massive elsewhere, so you know, you guys need to catch on.
Yeah.
But with me they were actually quite nice.
Mm-hmm.
So I have only the coolest memories of that, and you know, to be able to sit here years later and you know, see what they became and then hear those records that followed, that to me showed huge improvements.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to say, wow, I saw Oasis at J.C. Dobbs and it wasn't even sold out. It's one of those like, I was there, man.
There was a lot of rows going on, a lot of fighting.
Mm.
So, you know, if I was there for that, it wasn't calmed down. Oh, don't do this in front of him. You know, it just, everything just evolved organically, you know.
Mm. And was there much of a, oh no, you can't put that out, or you can't say they were taking drugs, or you can't say, it was just like, fine.
No. Funny enough, with Forever the People, there was a hint of, you know, the drug thing is boring now, blah blah blah. But by then it was a different kettle of fish. Because you see that tour, that Be Here Now tour was a slog.
Yeah.
It wasn't fun anymore. And I think I was saying Forever the People, suddenly all they kept talking about was, you know, 10 years previous, being stuck in some van going up to Leeds to play One Man and His Dog, and you know, getting caught by the police, or you know, shenanigans, or you know, just that.
Yeah.
Because suddenly it felt like it was just a job. It was just a slog, and
yeah,
it was funny because I'd been on tours before. I think everything leading up to Nebworth was just magical, and I think after Nebworth, it started to become something completely different to what it had been.
Yeah.
Fun kind of went from it, really.
Yeah. Well, I've got Matt Whitecross, director of Supersonic, coming on in a bit. And
lovely guy.
Oh, good. And I've heard him in other interviews sort of saying, you know, when people have said, well, why did you stop at Nebworth? And, you know, it's, well, with every band, the journey to get there is always the most interesting bit, you know.
Absolutely. The journey upwards... It's the most exciting bit. Once you get to the top, once you've achieved, well, you know, I said to you, he didn't use it, Matt, but I said this line to him. The trouble with Oasis was they had all these dreams about being huge rock and roll stars, and they wrote records called Rock and Roll Star, you know, about those desires, and that they wanted to live in big houses and sleep with amazing-looking women and take the best drugs and drink the finest champagne. You know, they wanted that. Yeah, classic rock style thing, and they got it. And once they got it, they didn't know what to do because they'd achieved their dreams. And what I said to Matt was, what you have to do somehow is go back to bed and dream up another load of dreams and then follow them. But, you know, by then it was just too late, and it was a crazy, you know, I mean, what, half a million people were out bought, over half a million people were out bought being now on the first day of release.
Yeah.
Just craziness, you
madness.
Know. Yeah, it was absolute madness. And I think it kind of, and then, like they say in that documentary, you know, suddenly they were surrounded by a lot of men with man bags, you know. You've got to do this, you've got to do that, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. And, you know, I remember thinking after Nebworth, you should, Sunday night in Nebworth, you should have just said, you know what, that's it, see you later.
Yeah.
And then it would have gone down in history. It would have just been amazing. But instead, it kind of slowly kind of disintegrated, didn't it?
The biggest, you know, the one before Christmas was Liam.
Yeah.
And it was the Supersonic film.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't plan going back to the hotel. It was actually Brian Cannon who said, "Yo, come here to the hotel." I was legless, let's put it that way. So I had a bit of confidence behind me. Come on then, fuck it, let's have it. So went into the hotel in town, up a few floors, and there was like a balcony bar or whatever. It was hammered, lots of people there. And I said, "Where's Liam?" I said, over there. I went over and I just stood him. I went, "Oi." And he just stood up, the biggest Tony man, fuck it. And you know what? It was brilliant. It was absolutely excellent to see him.
Great.
You know, it really was. And I was so nervous, if you like. And it was 20 odd years. And I'm like, Jesus, how's this going to go? I was out of my face, is the truth, drunk. And it was like, couldn't even get me fucking words out. And even, you know, that would have been difficult, maybe sober.
Yeah.
But, you know, it, you know, compliments to Liam. Paul Debbie's new partner over and said, "Look, we need a chat in there, me and him." Found us a table and sat with him. He brought over this 3-part shot I've never seen in my life. It probably cost about 300 quid each, you know. But fuck me, I was out of my head after that. I was like, what? But just natural chat. It was like, "How's your man over here?" Blah, blah, blah. And it was brilliant. It really was. And then a few people started surrounding the table and throwing a bit. He was like, right, enough. So, but just that initial contact, hello, blah, 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 and walked away feeling on top of the world, I really did. But, you know, well, look, I do respect him. I know he's got a nuts life, he really has.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's a great guy, he really is. I know he's still there. So.
Yeah, no, that's great. That's really nice you had that and sort of... I mean, and one of the questions that one of the guys asked actually is if Liam had got in touch and said, "Tony, come and drum for my new solo band," would you have done that?
I don't have to answer that, do I? Without a doubt, yes. Without a doubt. I'd love that. My God, yes. Without a doubt, I'd love to open up and be there, be part of it.
Yeah.
somewhat a reunion, as I referred to it at one point.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Well, Bone had got on stage. I don't know if you saw this, but Bone had got on stage with him at Manchester a couple of nights ago. Yeah, yeah. So the gig back, or yesterday. Yeah. So the Manchester Ritz gig, and Bone had came on. They finished with Be Here Now, and Bone had came on and played that with him.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was nice to see.
You know, all I can say is thank God for Facebook and live streaming, because I did try for a ticket, honestly. I wouldn't, you know, I don't want anything for anything, but I didn't, anything for nothing even. I didn't try then too hard for a guest list, but I was like, in my heart and soul, I was like, I want to see this, I want to know what's up, I want to know, I want to be there, I really want to be there. So I didn't get a ticket, and, you know, I heard they were going for stupid money outside, which, considering the point of... which again is a great point, Liam donating all the funds to what's recently happened in Manchester, that wouldn't have been the right thing to do. So anyway, clicked on Facebook at home, like, oh my God, I'm there.
You can watch it. Yeah. You're not getting beer spilt on you and ruining your shoes either.
Exactly, with my brew at home. I'm like, yeah, nice one, feet up. And yeah, brilliant gig, without a doubt.
So anyone out there moaning that they didn't get a ticket, Tony McCarroll didn't get a ticket, so stop moaning if Tony
can. Do you know what I mean? Do you know who I am, for God's sake?
That's it. And until next time, stay in touch, stay engaged, and stay young.
Thank you.